When Millard Fillmore shat the bed as president, Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan were like, hold my beer. This is Reframing America. She had three sons. Her first son died when he was only 3 days old. Her second son died when he was 4 years old. No doubt she was relieved and overjoyed when her third son, Benny, was able to navigate the dangers of early childhood, and she watched him grow from a baby into a little boy. It was January 6th, 1853, and the woman, whose name was Jane, was traveling by train with her husband and little Benny, 11 years old. Suddenly, the rear axle of the passenger car broke, and the train slipped from the icy tracks. Jane's husband, seated next to her, grabbed her, and then he tried to grab Benny, who had been sitting in the seat behind them. The train plummeted and tumbled 20 feet down. The number of deaths in the accident could have been far greater, but that was of no comfort to Jane, for the one and only casualty was her third and final son, Benny, whose head had been crushed. The horrific memory of seeing Benny's body would haunt Jane and her husband for the rest of their lives. Beset with grief, she couldn't even bring herself to attend Benny's funeral. January 1853 should have marked the beginning of the greatest era of Jane's life. For just the previous November, her husband, a New Hampshire politician named Franklin Pierce, had been elected President of the United States and was to be sworn in that March. Instead of being the crowning achievement of her life, as the wife of the president, Jane Pierce receded from the public for the next 4 years, becoming known as the Shadow of the White House. The death of 11-year-old Benny Pierce, an American son who was killed when a train went off its rails, is not only a personal tragedy for his family, but also a harbinger of the massacre to come. Over the next 12 years, a period beginning with his father's presidency, Americans would lose 600,000 more sons when, like Benny Pierce's fateful train, the entire country would run completely off its rails. Welcome, with a heavy heart, to Reframing America. My name is Tony Rydberg, and riding the rails with me as ever is Ryan Rasmussen. Hello, Ryan, how are you?
Well, after hearing that, I've been better.
That's a really bold stroke. Sorry to start you out in a pretty dark place there, folks. But as I'm putting this episode together, I thought, you know what? The story of little Benny Pierce, as horrific as it is actually a pretty appropriate place to start for the era we are about to talk about today on this episode of Reframing America. Before we get to the history, we got to go back and correct the record, Ryan. Sorry to do this to you, but we got caught up in a little bit of misogyny last episode, Ryan. So we just got to talk about a couple things. First of all, Ryan, you got in trouble. Because when we were talking about the gold rush, you made a comment about how, oh, no wonder it was so messy around there because there were no women there to clean up after the men. And so your presumption that the women needed to be there to clean up after the messy men was, it was noted. Do you have anything you want to say in your defense there, Ryan?
I should probably not. Well, no, I will. I will.
You're just gonna keep on digging, just like those gold.
No, before I met my wife, I was not a very neat and tidy person, and I have become a much neater and tidier person. And okay, like I said, my college apartment was like it was just a pigsty. We were awful, and okay, then I started spending most of my time at her apartment, and I realized that this is how the other half lives, and this is much nicer. And it's from personal experience.
Yeah, and they elevate life. They make life better. Yeah, so anyway, I'm sure that's not what you meant, Ryan. I got caught up in a little misogyny as well. You're not alone in this, Ryan, because when we were talking about Millard Fillmore's wife, Abigail, I said that she was the first lady to have a job. And as I'm sure both of us will happily attest, being a mother is certainly a job as well. So there have been many first ladies who had jobs prior to the paid job that Abigail Fillmore had as a school teacher. So to the 25% of our audience who is a woman, we wanted to say we apologize. No hard feelings there. Going into listener mail, we put out a poll on Twitter, which kind of caught fire last month, and we asked the question, which relationship is weirder? Now, Millard Fillmore, as just mentioned, married his former teacher, Abigail, and Zachary Taylor, President Zachary Taylor, had a son-in-law who was Jefferson Davis, who then became the president of the Confederate States. So we put the poll out, and Millard Fillmore won 55% to 45%. So to those of you keeping score, marrying your former teacher is weirder and more sort of unforgivable than having your son-in-law be a traitor and the president of a country in rebellion. So this month, I thought I'd put out another poll. And Ryan, you are from Wisconsin. I am from Minnesota. Neither of us have had our beloved home state produce a president. We're talking today about Franklin Pierce from New Hampshire and James Buchanan from Pennsylvania. New Hampshire and Pennsylvania have only produced one president. Unfortunately, it's Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan. So my question to you, Ryan, is which is the better situation, to be from a state that has never produced a president, the situation you and I are in, or a situation where your state has produced a president, but it's seen as a pretty poorly performing president?
Oh, man. That's a really good question. I would say, oh, God, what would you say?
Well, I think we are in the better position as not having a president yet. And this is the Viking in me talking, because we can always look to the future. Stop laughing, Ryan. I'm being open and vulnerable with you. We are going to always look to the future. Someday our time will come, you know. Ryan and I have a colleague, Kelly, a wonderful colleague, and she's from Pennsylvania. And I asked her about this today, and she just sort of acknowledged, like, in Pennsylvania, we don't really like own it. We just kind of like let it be. So shout out to Kelly for being so open and honest. I appreciate that. Appreciate that perspective from the one Pennsylvanian that I know. So we'll put that out on Twitter. And so anybody who is on Twitter, find us at Painted Sky Pods and let us know your thoughts on that poll question. It should be up as you hear this episode. Talking a little history in the making, what's going on right now?
So literally this week was the first criminal trial of a president.
Yeah, right? Jury selection is going on right now for Donald Trump.
So the podcast I listened to this morning made me think of this. Tony.
Yes.
Do you think if you were, let's say you happen to be in the jury pool, do you think you could be selected? Could you prove to yourself and the lawyer teams that you could be impartial and fair Donald Trump being on trial?
That's a great question. You caught me completely flat-footed.
Welcome to what you do to me every single
month. I know,
month.
Right? So, Ryan, there's the person who I am, and there's the person who I want to be. And the person who I want to be could be impartial and say, I will sort the facts. I will sift through them. I will read the nuances of the laws. But I'm pretty
hold
sure.
Hold my citizen's duty.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel like I would actually probably convey them to this podcast and say, hey, can I play this couple selections from this podcast for you? Maybe that would actually get me out of jury duty.
Yeah, they apparently looked up people's social media accounts in real time and like brought up old posts to prove that they were like anti-Trump. So I definitely wouldn't make the cut. So
yeah,
I'm
I don't
sure
think
you
probably
would make either.
And the last thing I have for things that happened was that O.J. Simpson died recently. It's not going to make the history books, but I just wanted to throw that out there because I'm pretty sure O.J. Simpson is my least favorite cold-blooded killer in U.S. history. And so I just wanted to flag that because by the end of this episode, I will reveal my favorite cold-blooded killer in American history. So wait for that. So we'll check that out. Ryan, do you have a favorite cold-blooded killer in American history?
Probably one of the ones from Wisconsin because we're good at producing serial killers.
Yeah, I know. Which one? Can you be more specific? Yeah. We are talking about the years 1853 to 1861, 8 years, two presidents, and just a whole bunch of problems going on. Let's talk about where we came from into this era. Going back to the last episode, we had the great and vaunted Henry Clay, who fought and struggled all of his life to preserve this union. And our last episode, of course, he succumbs to his own mortality. He dies. He leaves us with the various measures of the Compromise of 1850, mainly the Fugitive Slave Act, which is just a real polarizing feature of our government, and sort of the last gasp of that second generation of Americans, Clay, Calhoun, Webster. We like to give a theme for each of the eras we're talking about. My theme for this one is, this is the great American give up. And I call it that because, shout out to my mom, who said I swore a little bit too much on the last episode. but I was going to call it the great American f*** it, but we're not going to call it that anymore because there's no more swearing. But this is, to me, Ryan, 8 years of the government and the governmental leaders just being like, I just can't fight over slavery anymore. I don't wanna. So let's just blah. So we're going to talk about a whole bunch of events here. I'd like to start with the election of 1852 because our guy, Franklin Pierce, one of our presidents here, he is nominated on the 49th ballot for the Democrats. 49th ballot, I can't imagine. Can you imagine, Ryan, watching C-SPAN for 48 ballots, getting nothing, and then this dude gets it on the 49th? Only got it because the other people, he wasn't even one of the main guys. It was Lewis Cass, it was James Buchanan, Stephen Douglas. none of them would go. And so the Democrats gave up and they said, fine, let's just get somebody else. Let's get this northern doe-faced dude who likes the South. And that's how we end up with Franklin Pierce as president. Landslide victory. So it's just wild to think that, number one, he's a kind of a give-up candidate. Number two, in 4 years, not only is he going to lose the presidency, but he's not even going to get renominated by the party, spoiler alert. And this dude is just sort of fumbling around in the White House for 4 years. But that's what I got for the election of 1852. I can't even remember who did he run against? Oh, yeah, well,
he ran against his old commanding officer from when he served in the Mexican-American War, Winfield
that's
Scott.
That's right. Yeah,
which is interesting. He literally, yeah, like he was his direct commanding officer in the war.
So talk about revenge. Yeah, he whoops up on Winfield Scott.
One newspaper at the time called it, quote, the most ludicrous, ridiculous, and uninteresting presidential campaign in history.
Really? Yeah. That's saying something. So here we get Franklin Pierce, and he rolls into the presidency, and then he's just kind of tootling along, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. We get to 1854 and a little thing called the Kansas-Nebraska Act. I've been talking a lot. I want to throw this to you. Can you just give us kind of a background on what the heck is going on with Kansas-Nebraska?
Yeah, so Kansas and Nebraska were unorganized territories before this, meaning they had no path to statehood. And that's because Southerners had blocked it because all of that territory would have been above the old Missouri Compromise line, which would have meant they would have been free states. Stephen Douglas, senator from Illinois, had an interest to turn those into organized territories so that they could then become states, because he had this vision that the Transcontinental Railroad that they were starting to talk about would go through Chicago, take a more northerly route. And he needed those territories then to be states. So he's the one kind of, you know, pushing this law. And so what it did is it created Kansas and Nebraska as organized territories and allowed them, you know, then become states eventually. And it got rid of the old Missouri Compromise line completely. So all of those territories then, it would be popular sovereignty. So the people, the settlers moving into those areas could vote on the issue of slavery. And it just completely broke the Whig Party. This is like the final thing that, I mean, it was already on like its last legs, but this is basically the Whigs disintegrate as a political party and the Republicans start to coalesce. But it also divided the Democrats into a northern and southern faction. Mm-hmm. And in the next election, they run multiple candidates. They basically run a northern candidate and a southern candidate, which splits the vote and allows Lincoln to win not in 1856, but in 1860, right?
Right.
And then it leads into Bleeding Kansas, which is the next kind of big deal in the whole thing, which, you know, 55 people are killed trying to, you know, there was a slavery side, a free soil side, and both, you know, they're fighting, and there's multiple attempts to like convince Washington that they voted on the Constitution, and there's basically two state capitals. It's a messy affair.
It is a messy affair. And again, going back to the Great American Give Up, you've mentioned twice, or actually you've mentioned just now and then in the previous episode, popular sovereignty. Just let the people decide. Let them just have a vote, which in theory sounds great. But again, it's kind of a give up because, as you said, settlers can come in. So what we get, you get all these anti-slavery abolitionist people who are not currently in the territory. One of the families that starts to move out into Kansas is a little family named the Brown family. And one of John Brown's sons is one of the many people who go into Kansas. And in response to that, or maybe in parallel with that, you got these border ruffians, as they were known, these people from Missouri bordering on Kansas, who are like, wait a minute, all these outsiders are going to come in and they're going to like throw the vote. And these Missourians are going in and they are kind of, they're being ruffians. And it's so many outsiders. It's not like the people, the pioneers who were settling Kansas are deciding this. This is like outsiders, as I understand it, kind of coming in and just kind of messing things up. Those border ruffians, I should mention, they were led by a guy named David Rice Acheson, who came up in the last episode. And I wanted to just go back and talk about him one more time, because he was the guy who was president for one day between the terms of Polk and Taylor. And I mentioned this guy in the last episode, like, oh, what a funny thing. This guy thought he was president for a day. And then I'm reading about Bleeding Kansas. And it's like, oh, this dude is back in a big way. And he's like leading these forces and going into Lawrence, Kansas. And like, they burned Lawrence to the ground. And it's all sorts of just crazy stuff going on. You mentioned
we're skipping ahead to Buchanan, like basically the slave supporters tried to like push through this like vote and recognize the pro-slavery government, even though there was a lot of evidence that they were in the minority. And the territorial governor of Kansas was like, no, don't legitimize this vote. And Buchanan was so concerned with being sympathetic to the South that he was going to recognize Kansas as a slave state. And at the last minute, Stephen Douglas had to step in and stop it and ensure an actual legitimate vote. And when they did that, in the end, the Free Soilers did win and Kansas became a free state. But it's moving ahead to Buchanan a little bit, but it just gives you a sense again of like how dysfunctional this whole affair was and how badly both Pierce and Buchanan handled it.
Yeah. And like you said, two capitals, the Lecompton capital, which was the pro-slavery forces. Topeka was a capital for the anti-slavery forces. It was, an absolute mess. One of the things that I found fascinating was with this Lecompton government, this pro-slavery government, they set up a whole bunch of laws. And I just have a pop quiz for you, Ryan. According to the laws set forth by the pro-slavery Lecompton government in Kansas, what was the penalty for distributing abolitionist literature?
I'm going to guess. Death penalty?
Yes. Yeah, capital punishment. Are you kidding me? So, we got this whole mess going on in Kansas and Nebraska. Stephen Douglas starts it. Then he's like, he's like Dr. Frankenstein. He's created this monster, and now he's trying to stop it, right? The one other thing I wanted to talk about, and I can't remember the exact year of this, but the Pottawatomie slaughter. I read a great book, The Zealot and the Emancipator by H.W. Brands. Really enjoyed that book, and it was all about the parallel lives of John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. John Brown, famous for Harper's Ferry, which we'll get to later, one of his sons goes to Kansas and sends him a letter that says, "Hey, Dad, can you send us some weapons?" And John Brown is like, "I'll do you one better. I'll go out there myself." So John Brown, who later is famous for Harper's Ferry, ends up in Kansas. He and his sons go out into the territory. They murder five pro-slavery, but not necessarily slave-owning people. They take swords to them. They don't kill them with guns. They go old school and they pull out these swords and they chop these people up and they pull these husbands out of bed from their wives and they just basically like, "Come with us." And that's like the last time they ever saw their family. And John Brown is a cold-blooded killer and he's a flawed man. But you know what? He's my favorite cold-blooded killer in the history of this country. And then the last thing about Kansas, it revives the political career of one Abraham Lincoln, drives him back into politics. And so Stephen Douglas, interestingly, kind of awakens the sleeping giant. Lincoln was out of politics and he comes back in. And then, of course, in a couple of years, they'll be debating one another. And then Douglas will lose the presidency to him in 1860. So, like, even though this is over a long stretch of time, the whole Kansas-Nebraska situation, just kind of the engine that drives all of the hatred here. Stephen Douglas wanted a literal transcontinental railroad to go through Chicago and into the West. There were also metaphorical railroads going on. And I wonder, Ryan, if we could take a moment just to make sure on this show to talk about something called the Underground Railroad. And this has been going on for quite a while by the time we get to this point in our history. But I just had a couple of thoughts about the Underground Railroad, and I wanted to get your thoughts on them. Number one, the coolest thing that I found about the Underground Railroad was that we don't know how many people were involved in this. And that's maybe my favorite fact about the Underground Railroad, because these people just took these secrets to their graves. So I like that. But it's also, Ryan, part of the Great American Give Up, because the enslaved people had given up on waiting for the South to stop slavery. The enslaved people had given up on the North saving them from slavery, because, of course, the Underground Railroad doesn't take you to the North. The Underground Railroad takes you to Canada. We know about Harriet Tubman. I did not know about the name William Still. Do you know who William Still is? So William Still is, he was a person of color. He himself was not an enslaved person, but his parents were. He was born in New Jersey after his father bought his freedom and his mother escaped. And he grew up and he became part of the Vigilance Society, which I didn't know what was a thing, but it's sort of the official arm of the Underground Railroad. It was an actual like office in cities all around the country, in Philadelphia, New York. And people would come in, and it wasn't always about slaves, but it was just help for people of color. One day, this dude walks in. This is one of my Stranger Than Fictions for the day. This guy walks in and says, you know, he's a former slave. He bought his freedom, but he wants to find his parents, and he wants to get his wife and his kids out of the South. And William Still is there, and he's like, "Oh, great. Tell me your parents' names." And his parents' names were Levin and Sidney Still. And William Still said, "What? Those are my parents' names." And this was his brother who like walked into his office after like 30, 40 years, you know? And it was just like this crazy, crazy story. There's just so much here about the Underground Railroad. I wanted to get your thoughts on it. And I also wanted to ask you, Ryan, would you have been an agent on the Underground Railroad had you lived during that time?
Man, I'd like to think so, but it's also, you know, risky. And if you have kids, I don't know.
Yeah. It's like being a juror on the Trump trial. You know, it's like, I like to think I would, but I don't know if I would. Anyway, Ryan, tell me about the Underground Railroad. What do you say about it? What do you teach about it? What do you know about it? What do you love about it?
To be honest, we don't cover it a ton. It's literally one slide when we cover Southern society in the 1800s up till the Civil War. Yeah, I mean, I think it gets covered in like books and stories more. There's not really much more to say than one slide, especially with all the other stuff we have to cover. We don't go into detail on it. So,
okay. Yeah. And your students know that it's not an actual railroad, right?
I would hope so. Yes.
I hope so. I really hope so. Okay. So then Buchanan gets nominated, and James Buchanan, who's been around forever, he becomes our president. And boy, are we in for a good time. Franklin Pierce gets the dubious distinction of being the only sitting president to be denied renomination by his party. They give it to Buchanan. It's a three-way race between Buchanan and Fremont, who's the Republican, and Millard Fillmore, who's still kicking around with the Know-Nothing American Party. Buchanan wins. He's been a political mainstay for many years, so surely we are in good hands. 2 days into his tenure as president, the Supreme Court of the United States hands down a decision called the Dred Scott case. Ryan, can you give us some background on this bad boy?
Yeah, so Dred Scott was an enslaved person who his owner had taken him into free territory, including Minnesota. I think they lived in the area around Fort Snelling, and they returned home. So he sued, saying that his time, you know, living in free territory meant he deserved freedom. And the Supreme Court said absolutely not. You know, it was property and nothing more. That enslaved people of color had no more rights than a horse, essentially. And that ownership was protected and guaranteed by the Constitution. But they went even further than that. They basically stated that the Missouri Compromise had been unconstitutional, and that slavery could not be banned in new territories, nor in new states. That was entirely up to the voters of that place when they wrote a constitution. So they tried to essentially repeal the Missouri Compromise line. So universally regarded as not just a terrible decision, obviously, but it's in the running for the worst decision in the history of the Supreme Court, especially the majority opinion that was issued by Roger Taney, which is just a terrible, terrible piece of writing.
Right.
And Buchanan, and to be clear, Buchanan supported the decision and was okay. It was good with it.
Yeah. And not only supported the decision, but put pressure on a Northern justice, Justice Greer, because Buchanan was worried that this was just going to be, oh, these Southern judges are doing it. So he needed a Northern judge, a Northern justice. And so this Justice Greer, who was from Pennsylvania, Buchanan kind of put his thumb on the scale and said, I need you to work with Taney. And I found out it was Roger Taney, apparently. People keep saying Taney. I don't know. Whatever.
Who gives a how you pronounce his name?
Quincy Taney. Buchanan gets in there, and even before he's even president, and he kind of gets this justice to fall in line. Dred Scott, I mean, he goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says to him, yeah, not only are you a slave, you don't even have standing to have brought this case in the first place because you're not even a citizen. It's just like, and again, it is another example, to go back to my theme, of the great American give up. This was the Supreme Court being like, oh, let's not worry about, just, you're all slaves. None of you are citizens. You're all, no states are free states. Let's just be done.
See, I disagree. I don't think it's the Supreme Court giving up. I think it's the Supreme Court digging in and trying to further the cause of slavery and do what they can to literally protect the institution. So I don't think it's a give up. I think it's the opposite of a give up. I think it's them digging in, trying to protect the institution.
But that's my theme, Ryan. You don't understand? I have a theme going on here. So not only is this a horrible decision, and I agree with you. I found many things that said just worst decision ever. We have a panic of 1857. Great job, Buchanan.
Oh, that's not his fault.
No, I know. I'm just piling on. So we got 1857. We're in economic crisis. We have the worst Supreme Court case in history. Everyone is pissed off at everybody else, leading to another event, which is the siege at Harper's Ferry with the aforementioned John Brown. Another great American give up. John Brown has just given up waiting for us to be reasonable. And he's like, screw it. I'm going to start another slave revolt myself. Goes to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, brings his sons, gets a couple of his sons killed. But of course, Robert E. Lee very famously puts down Harper's Ferry. Ryan, last episode, you mentioned Zachary Taylor and his death being one of the most important deaths in American history, or at least among presidents. I would submit to you, Ryan, wonder what your thoughts are on this, that John Brown not being killed at Harper's Ferry is one of the great non-deaths in American history. What do you think about that, Ryan?
I would like for you to explain why.
I'm really glad. Because people thought he was a nut job. And had he been killed, he would have died a nut job. But he got to go to trial. He got to comport himself with grace and dignity and clarity. And it was almost like through this trial, he went from being a nut job radical, which is how, of course, the Southerners painted him, into this very principled, but obviously very violent man of sort of ideals. And he kind of became a folk hero. And had he not survived Harper's Ferry, there is no John Brown's body, you know, being sung, all that kind of stuff. He becomes a folk hero because of the way he was able to comport himself in his trial.
So yeah, James Lowen, who wrote the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, which is like a classic for U.S. Great history book. Teachers.
Read that book.
He cited that as an example, John Brown, of treatment of historical figures, because like there's a very famous painting of John Brown with like a tornado in the background. He's like got both, he's holding off both sides, and he looks like this crazed figure. He looks like a crazy person, but then you can compare that to his actual like photograph where he, I mean, he looks like an intense figure, but he's not like a crazy looking person. And, right. And just kind of how the South changed the perception of him with the Lost Cause and all that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of tense. We got Harper's Ferry. The Southerners are outraged and the Northerners are outraged and everybody is outraged. And that leads us, I think, Ryan, to 1860. And boy, oh boy, as you said, Stephen Douglas, Dr. Frankenstein, who created the monster of Kansas, Nebraska, then tried to sort of pull back on it after it all kind of spun out of control and Buchanan is trying to hoist up this fraudulent government in there. He's running for the Democrats. Vice President Breckinridge is also running for the Democrats. Buchanan is not running because he's 70 years old and he promised one term, I believe. So they sort of split their own ticket and allow a gentleman by the name of Abraham Lincoln, already mentioned, to win in the most geographically lopsided victory, as I understand it, in the history of the country. But that's hardly the end of it, because after he is elected, Ryan, how do the Southerners take his victory?
Well, in December 20th, South Carolina secedes. Yeah. And then in January, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana secede. And then in February, Texas.
Can you imagine?
Civil War hasn't started yet. Civil War doesn't technically start yet, but they've all seceded.
Right. Buchanan's
reaction is notoriously bad, and that's like a lot of reason why he gets. I mean, that's his biggest like historical criticism. He doesn't do anything.
So Buchanan's inaction leads to. I'm really excited, Ryan. That we've actually come to the point of the show where I have been waiting to ask you this question for a really long time. So we're going to build a Mount Rushmore right now, Ryan. I want to build the Mount Rushmore of great steaming turds, outgoing presidents are leaving incoming presidents. Okay. Because I think Buchanan is a pretty good place to have this conversation. Imagine Abraham Lincoln looking at the country burning down and being like, oh, James, like what you did with the place, you know? I mean, so here's what I got for you. I made a list. Now, this does not count presidents who died unexpectedly and left their vice presidents. This is like, hey, my job is done. Have fun, big guy. But I made a quick list of some of the great steaming turds that presidents have left for their successors. Thomas Jefferson leaves to James Madison, economic downturn, upheaval, and then tensions with England that turn into the War of 1812. Andrew Jackson leaves for Martin Van Buren, the Panic of 1837, and the Trail of Tears. James Buchanan leaves for Lincoln, the Civil War. Herbert Hoover leaves for FDR, the Great Depression, and the Dust Bowl. LBJ leaves to Nixon, Vietnam. Bush, the second Bush.
Well, Nixon leaves to Ford. Watergate.
And And I wasn't sure if I should put that one on there because of the resignation. But yeah, we can put that in there. Nixon leaves to Ford. Nixon's resignation. Bush leaves for Obama, the Great Recession and two wars. And Trump leaves for Biden, COVID, and January 6th. So that's eight if you count Nixon. Ryan, I'm going to give you four spots for the Mount Rushmore of great steaming turds. First of all, is there anything I missed? And second of all, what are you going with?
No, you hit all the ones that I was thinking about as soon as you mentioned it. I'm not going to put Trump on there just because as much as I hate him, you can't blame him for COVID. I know he handled it badly, but I'm going to do Bush just because it was all cell phone. Iraq was all him.
Cell phone, not cell phone. It's not a cell phone. Yeah. Yes, I know. Just literally, like, I heard cell phone and I was like, what do you mean cell phone? It was a cell phone. Okay. You got Bush for Obama.
I'm going to say Hoover.
Hoover for FDR.
Buchanan.
That's a pretty strong case. Yeah.
That's three, right? How many do I have?
That's
left?
Three. You have one more. You can have, I got Jefferson, Jackson, LBJ. Looks like those are the ones that are left.
Man, I hate to do it to LBJ. No, you know what? No, I'm not going to do it to LBJ. Oh, man. Well, whatever. LBJ, I guess. Yeah.
LBJ. Okay. LBJ.
Yeah, just because, as much as I like LBJ for other things, yeah, again, it's a cell phone. Like, he didn't have to get involved in Vietnam, and it was just a boondoggle. So I'll say Vietnam. Okay. I'll say LBJ. Yeah.
Okay. I went with Buchanan, I think, is the number one seed. That's a pretty good one. Yeah, I went Buchanan. I went Hoover. That's a pretty strong number two seed. I went with Jackson because, like you said, Jackson's the Panic of 1837 and the Trail of Tears were policy that he instituted. And so I'm going to go ahead and say that he left that to his little sidekick, Van Buren. And then the last one, I was going to go with Trump. I'm not going to lie. I mean, COVID wasn't his fault, but January 6th, that was his fault, I think.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
I went with those four. Thank you for playing the Mount Rushmore of great steaming turds. I really appreciate that. Going into the question of for better, for worse, I think it's pretty clear that the country is worse off, Ryan. Do you agree by the end of this 8-year span?
Yeah, I think it's the most clear-cut one we've done so far.
Okay, here is my question. This nation prides itself on its constitution, and we can survive anything. We weather all the storms. Is there a case to be made that the Constitution and our country actually didn't survive this? Because as I think about it, I'm like, the country fell apart and we got lucky, maybe, that the right guy comes along, like Abraham Lincoln and his leadership pulls us out of there. But is there a case to be made that this actually broke our country and we actually didn't survive and we had to kind of put it back together?
Well, I mean, in a way, Reconstruction is considered like a second founding, and I'm not making that term up. That's I believe that's Eric Foner that said that. Yeah. It was basically a chance to redo with the Reconstruction Amendments and some of the civil rights laws that were passed. I don't know if it. No, I mean, it's like in Friends. You know, we were on.
Oh my God, I love this.
We were on a break. You know, like.
Yeah.
Right,
we were on a break. Yeah,
we were on a break. Okay. So no, it wasn't a divorce. It was a short-term separation, so no. A lot of countries go through civil wars. It's super common. It happens to everyone. So the fact that we went through one doesn't make us strange. It makes us normal.
Welcome to the party, pal. Well, we have my favorite purchase of all the land we've purchased, Ryan. I don't know why, but I've always had a soft spot for the Gadsden Purchase of 1853. We got the Louisiana Territory. We got all the stuff that Polk did. But this little strip of land that makes up Arizona and part of New Mexico or whatever, the Gadsden Purchase.
No, James, it's not. Gadsden. Not. It's just a small. It's not all of Arizona. It's just like a small little strip.
Right. It's just a little strip at the bottom, right? $15 million. And just like that, Ryan, the contiguous United States are complete. A couple of states come into the Union. The aforementioned Kansas comes in right at the end of, 1860. And it's like, hey, guys, thanks for having me. You know, so we get Kansas after. Meanwhile, the states are going left and right. Kansas comes in January 29th, 1861. We've already lost a couple states. It's ridiculous. Kansas joins us. Gadsden Purchase. Oregon joins us. And obviously, Ryan, 1858. The beautiful state of Minnesota comes into the country. Now, at first, I was bummed that this beautiful state came in during the worst presidency in our history. And yet, I'm comforted by that because you know what? Minnesota came in when the country needed her the most. And so just a quick list I made for you, Ryan. This is just my special gift for you. Quick list of the contributions that Minnesota has made to this beloved nation. The territory, as you mentioned, that made Dred Scott believe he was a free man. The first state to offer volunteers to the Union Army in the Civil War. The state that consistently ranks among the best voter turnout and best places to live. It gave us Charles Lindbergh. It gave us the Mayo Clinic. It gave us 3M. It gave us Target. It gave us pacemakers, post-it notes, and spam. It gave us Nobel Prize winner Sinclair Lewis, Nobel Prize winner Bob Dylan. It gave us Charles Schulz, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Tim O'Brien, the voice of Vietnam, Louise Erdrich, the voice of Native Americans. It gave us the first major regional theater in the country in the Guthrie Theater. It gave us the Andrews Sisters and Prince. It gave us Judy Garland, the Coen Brothers, and Vince Vaughn, water skiing, coach of the Miracle on Ice, Herb Brooks, Roger Maris, Dave Winfield, Paul Molitor, and the greatest World Series of all time. Those are just some of the things that Minnesota has given.
You missed a couple.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Bob Dylan.
Yeah, Bob Dylan, Nobel Prize winner, Bob Dylan.
Oh, I didn't hear. Oh, okay. Yeah. We can kind of count. He went to U of M. Norman Borlaug.
Oh, who's Norman Borlaug? Should I know that?
He's the main scientist credited with kickstarting the Green Revolution, which is something we cover in our class.
Well, and we also mentioned in a previous episode, Prohibition. There you go, guys. Yeah. Have a little Prohibition. Yeah, what are you going to do?
Volstead Act, yeah.
The Volstead Act. Good old Volstead. Clearly, he's from Minnesota with a name like Volstead. So, welcome to all those lovely states. Stranger than fiction. What is the weirdest fact from this era? Ryan, what you got?
There was an American mercenary and a filibuster pirate, essentially, William Walker, who briefly became the president of Nicaragua. And he was actually recognized by Pierce. Basically, he was part of this mercenary. He led this mercenary force that overtook Nicaragua. And it was an attempt to, like in Cuba and like these other Latin American countries, create a slave colony in Central America that would eventually become a slave state. He ended up basically pissing off railroad tycoon Cornelius Vanderbilt and also pissing off the British Empire. So he was forced out. He was eventually captured by the British Navy, handed over to the Honduran government, who then executed him by a firing squad. But there was an American who was briefly president of Nicaragua. I had one more. Would you count the caning of Charles Sumner?
That's literally what I had on my
list. You go through it. You can go through it then.
So Charles Sumner, this very vocal anti-slavery advocate, he's a senator, and he's on the Senate floor making a speech, and he is beaten senseless by Preston Brooks. Just beats the living daylights out of him. He's unconscious. He loses, some brain function or something? I mean, he is whooped. It was spurred forth by this Brooks, who was just incensed that, you know, someone was daring to speak up for these people of color, you know?
Well, that's not why, though, actually.
Oh, is that not why? Did I do it wrong?
Sumner insulted a kinsman of Preston Brooks.
Oh, my bad.
It's okay. He insulted a fellow Southerner who was a distant cousin of Brooks, and Brooks took it as a personal assault, and that's why he went and did that. And the interesting, he got basically no punishment. He resigned his seat, but then won special election. But he got his comeuppance because do you know what happened to him within weeks of that?
I know nothing other than the beating.
He died a brutal death from croup. Basically, he suffocated to death while alive because his lungs were closed off. And witnesses said that it was really horrific. So he got his comeuppance.
Well, now I feel a little bit bad for him, but he still shouldn't have done that. Just a couple other things for Stranger Than Fiction. I found this funny. After the Democrats denied Pierce re-election or renomination, they added a plank to their official platform that said, "We're not going to nominate this guy, but we totally support his administration." So I thought that was kind of great little political double messaging. he sucks. We're not going to bring him back. But he did a great job. Bring it back. Ryan, what do we got to bring back from this very, very rough time?
I had to think about it, and I don't know if I fully believe in this, but presidents who have served in the armed forces, which is a lot more difficult today in today's, post-Cold War world where less than 1% of our country serves in the armed forces. But just some stats for you. Pierce and Buchanan were our 14th and 15th presidents, respectively. Mm-hmm. But of our first 21 presidents, how many of them do you think served in some capacity?
Mm-hmm.
Of the first 21?
Let's see.
I'll give you three choices. I'll give you three choices. 14, 18, or 20.
I'm going to go with 18. Why not?
Who are the three that didn't?
John Adams.
Yes.
James Madison.
No. He actually served in the Virginia militia. Yeah, he served in the militia.
Oh, shut me up. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm thrown off. John Quincy.
Yes.
Yes. And Buchanan, wasn't it? He was never in the military, was he?
No, Buchanan briefly served in the War of 1812. He was
an, oh my god!
He didn't receive any action. It was Martin Van Buren. And many of our early presidents actually served in wars, right? Like Washington and Monroe served in the Revolution. Jackson, William Henry Harrison, James Buchanan in the War of 1812, though Buchanan didn't see any action. The Mexican-American War had Zachary Taylor and Franklin Pierce. The Civil War would have Grant, Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, and Chester Arthur, though Arthur didn't see combat, right? So a lot of presidents up until the 20th century, you know, served.
Thank you. I like it. What I would like to bring back is intellectual debate as popular entertainment. And going back to our guy Stephen Douglas and our guy Abraham Lincoln, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858 for the Illinois Senate seat, even though, just to be clear for people listening, they weren't running for Senate exactly, because, of course, senators weren't elected directly by the people. But they traveled Illinois, and they had the series of debates. I think our country would be very well served, not just during election season, but just periodically, kind of like there's a podcast, Intelligence Squared, shout out to Intelligence Squared. It's just debates. It's Oxford style debating on America's shores, as they call it. And check that podcast out. It's really good. And I think we should just have intellectual people who know what they're talking about, have intellectual debates. And I think we should all tune in. And I think we should air this stuff on TV, because I think that would really, really help with our discourse, because pardon me for saying this, but our political discourse needs a little bit of help.
I'm going to do a kind of add on to that.
Yes, please.
One of my favorite podcasts, just an episode, Plain English, which if you don't listen, you should listen to that, on just the dearth of media coverage on the actual like policy positions of Trump versus Biden and the policy implications of both, and like how media just doesn't cover policy. They cover the horse race element of politics, but they don't actually cover like the policy implications. And so like kind of like add on to yours. Yeah. Debates would be nice, but so would be just like media covering like actual potential policies of both groups. So
my brain is thirsty right now. Oh my gosh. I would love that so much. Origin stories. Ryan, the term first lady comes from this era. Do you know why?
Because she was the first lady to not host social events?
No, because James Buchanan was a bachelor and he did not have a wife. And his niece, Harriet Lane, was the official greeter and sort of official woman of the White House. But people were like, what do we call her? Let's call her the first lady. And so we owe Harriet Lane, James Buchanan's niece, that's where we get that phrase. I remember when we did the Monroe episode, I think they called her like Lady Presidentess or something like that. Like it was something really weird. But yeah, we got first lady from his niece. So thanks, James Buchanan, for never getting married. Ryan, let's get away from politics for a moment. What's the most important non-political thing that happened here?
The beginning of construction and the almost finish of the transcontinental telegraph line, not railroad. Right, which allowed for nearly instant communication from coast to coast. So, like, it used to take months for news to travel, and then it got down to weeks, but then it became instantaneous. So, trivia question. This obviously made the Pony Express obsolete, and the Pony Express is so, so famous. How long was the Pony Express actually in operation?
Oh!
Is it A, 18 months, B, 2 years, C, 4 years, D, 6 years?
Oh, gosh. Let's just go with 18. I'm pushing my chips in the middle of the table. Let's go 18 months, buddy.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
It gets so much coverage in popular culture. It literally was there for 18 months, for a year and a half.
Meanwhile, the Underground Railroad, which is freeing people for decades, it gets one slide in Ryan's class.
Well, to be fair, I have one bullet point for the Pony Express. So it's
Okay. That's proportionate. Okay.
Yeah.
So the Pony Express. I appreciate that. Wow. Yeah. That's awesome. My in other news is incredibly and entirely predictable, but it is the publication in 1855 of Walt Whitman's collection Leaves of Grass. Leave it to the English teacher to bring this up, but I bring it up not just because I'm a pretentious English teacher. I bring it up because when Leaves of Grass was published, this is free verse poetry, and nobody knew what the heck free verse poetry was. So they were reading this thing going, this is not poetry because it doesn't rhyme and it doesn't have a meter. This isn't a book because there aren't exactly characters in a plot. What is this? And not only does it create free verse poetry as a truly American art form, and honestly, there aren't a lot of truly American art forms, but it also sort of democratizes poetry in a way that you don't need to be a college-educated genius, you know, who can do all these intricate rhymes and allusions to ancient Greece and things like that. It just says, you know, write your heart, write your feelings, don't worry about rhyme, don't worry about whatever, and just capture the beauty and the purity of the moment. I think that just the introduction of this new art form, which made the writing of poetry more accessible to the people, made us better artists, and allowed us to do new things. So that's what I got for my In Other News, Walt Whitman. Nice job, buddy. Well, Ryan, we've talked about a lot of historical outrages already, but what is the greatest historical outrage from this era?
Southern secession.
That's a pretty good one. I had Dred Scott. I had the Dred Scott case.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. There's no losers here. Like, every one of these nominees is really, really great. I learned about the Mormon War, which I thought was very strange. 125 settlers from Arkansas were killed by the Mormons and Brigham Young, and it was for a long time blamed on Native Americans. And Buchanan sent like 2,500 troops in, and it was considered by the author of this the first militant internal rebellion in U.S. history, predating the Civil War. And so I thought that was kind of strange and unusual. So I didn't know.
Never heard of that. No.
Oh well, there you go. Maybe. And the other point the author made was it made Buchanan's position on the South all the more galling, because when the Mormons had an uprising that was violent, he was like, we're going to crush this. When the Southerners, who are his boys, had an uprising, he just kind of like, you know, and just kind of looked the other way. So it's not that he couldn't act. It's that he wouldn't act when it came to the South. I have like four nominees for worst person in America. I'm not sure who you, I mean, I started with one and it was Stephen Douglas. And then by the end of this, I didn't even have him on my list, even though he's like really, really racist. But I got four guys. Who's your worst person in America?
Funny enough, I originally started with Stephen Douglas. So I have two. I have the collective leadership of Southern slave owning societies, because F them.
Yep.
If you're going to make me choose an individual, I went with Roger Taney.
Yeah, he's on my list.
Just for his majority opinion. And, you know, just the line, quote, no rights, which referring to African-Americans, no rights, which any white man was bound to respect, which is just kind of like the piercing line of it. So I went with Roger Taney because F that guy.
Yeah. Oh, one of the things that I loved, because I'm also doing my Lincoln research right now, but Lincoln had a great response to this, as Lincoln always does, in that he said, you know, the Dred Scott decision says that people of color don't have the right to be citizens. And yet when the very constitution that created the Supreme Court was voted on by the people back in 1787, people of color in like five states voted, you know, it's like they literally gave you the power as citizens to become the Supreme Court. And then they're like, yeah, you're not citizens, you know? And I just thought that was such a brilliant way to look at it. Taney or Taney, however we're going to say it, is on our list. Doesn't matter. He sucks. David Rice Acheson for leading the Border Ruffians. I wanted to give him an honorable mention. Daniel Sickles, speaking of OJ, was kind of the OJ of his time. Buchanan sent him to England on some kind of diplomatic something or other. And Buchanan thought, oh, it'd be a nice little honeymoon for him and his new wife. And instead of bringing his wife, he brought his mistress and he left his pregnant wife at home. And then when he came home, he found out that his wife was shtupping the son of Francis Scott Key, writer of the Star Spangled Banner. And he kills Francis Scott Key's son for having an affair with his wife. And he gets not guilty by reason of insanity. And I was just like, OJ Simpson just died. That's really weird. The other guy I have is John B. Floyd, Secretary of War. And I just want to talk about this asshole for a moment. First of all, he was a very inept Secretary of War. This is Buchanan's guy. He's the one who sent the troops to Utah and was very aggressive about it. Scandal-ridden Secretary of War. But not only did he become a Confederate officer after the Civil War started, but before the Civil War started, as the Southern states are seceding, this guy, in the last days of Buchanan's presidency, is ordering equipment and money and provisions to be moved from Northern bases to Southern bases so that when the states seceded, they would be able to be like, oh, thanks for all this stuff, you know? And so this guy was like setting up the South for success even while he was in Buchanan's cabinet. And so that guy, I think he gets my choice for the worst of all of them.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. I've never heard of him.
But I love how both of us started with Stephen Douglas, and both of us are just like, oh, well, no, there's always someone worse, especially at this time. All right, you're off the hook, Stephen Douglas. Let's talk about these presidents. Franklin Pierce is the proud son, maybe not so proud son, of New Hampshire, and James Buchanan is from Pennsylvania, where they just are kind of like, yeah, he's our guy, whatever. For relationship status, we told the very sad story of Jane Pierce, possibly the saddest first lady in the history of our country. James Buchanan, as mentioned, the only bachelor president. A lot of speculation out there that he was gay. Ryan, question for you. What's the difference between historical speculation and just gossip? Does it matter whether or not this guy was gay? Should we know?
It would matter in the sense that, like, I mean, if we could confirm it, he'd be the first and only so far gay president. But I mean, like, it wouldn't matter that much because he wasn't openly gay. So, like, yeah, it doesn't really matter, I guess.
The only thing I could think of, because I went in being like, this is no one's business. We should not even be thinking about this. But the more I read about Buchanan and the more he had, it seems, some kind of romantic relationship with a gentleman named William R. King from Alabama, who was vice president under Franklin Pierce. He was vice president and then he dies before even being able to like take office. So Pierce did not have a vice president and Buchanan lost possibly the love of his life. These two were very close, and there was a lot of speculation about that he was Mrs. Buchanan. There was like a lot of kind of sophomoric jokes, but there's a lot of scuttlebutt about this guy. And the only thing I was thinking about was, if we need to understand Buchanan, and it's like, why was this guy so beholden to the South? If indeed he was in love with someone from the South who possibly had influence and contact with him and was able to kind of shape his views, that might help to explain it. But beyond that, beyond understanding his psychology, yeah, I don't think it's really anyone's business. So that's relationship status. The road to the presidency, you mentioned Pierce was in the military. Didn't exactly have a sterling career. He fell off his horse.
I literally have war hero in air quotes.
Yeah,
in my
seriously. Like, yeah. He's got diarrhea. Yeah. He had fainted. They called him Fainting Frank. I mean, he was just, he did not have a very sterling career. Buchanan, born in 1791 when Washington was president. He is so old, Ryan. His first political party was a Federalist. Do you know how many months it's been since we talked about the Federalist?
I know. When I was looking at him, I'm like, oh man, how old was he? Like, exactly. Yeah.
But then after that, a stirring resume, state and U.S. legislator, minister to Russia and Great Britain, U.S. senator, possible Supreme Court justice twice, and then three-time president candidate before.
Did you mention Secretary of State, too?
And Secretary of State. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, yeah. Secretary of State during a war with the Mexican-American War with Polk. So highly qualified. But again, both of these guys, kind of the great American give up. One of them, they're just like, 49th ballot, let's give it to this guy. And the other one's like, oh, you've been around long enough. Yeah, let's give it to you. Let's talk about C-SPAN presidential rankings. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have finally hit bottom. These two guys form an Andrew Johnson sandwich at the bottom of the C-SPAN rankings. There has never been a ranking where Buchanan was not the worst president, and there has never been a ranking where Franklin Pierce was not third from the bottom. In between those two is President Andrew Johnson.
It's amazing. Lincoln is literally surrounded by presidents 42 and 43 right before him. And right after him is 44. And spoiler alert, he's ranked number one in that list.
Yeah, he is.
It's just it's just crazy to think about.
Just because we got to give the guy that's their due, Pierce was just a bit worse than John Tyler, who was a secessionist by the end of his life. He was worse than William Henry Harrison, who died 1 month in. And he was just a little bit worse than Donald Trump. But just a little bit. His best marks were in administrative skills and economic management, and his worst marks were pursued equal justice for all and crisis leadership. Obviously, Kansas, Nebraska, a crisis through which he did not really lead us. Buchanan, kind of the same story. Great at international relations and administrative skills, although I went back and, you know, on these surveys, they have scores, like numbers. Buchanan's best quality as president was a half point higher than like Andrew Jackson's worst quality as president. So that kind of gives you an idea of like how far these guys have fallen. Crisis leadership, obviously the lowest score I have ever seen on any of these. Obviously did nothing to lead us through the crisis of secession. Just a horror show of just awful presidents. And like you said, they're back to back and we got the best guy coming up next. But woof, Ryan, I mean, what is there to say about these C-SPAN rankings? It's staggering.
Yeah. I mean, the closest we'll come to anything like this is George W. Bush, followed by Obama, followed by Trump. It's not nearly as extreme, but it's the closest we'll come to like just a up and down roller coaster of rankings.
Did you have any best quote or final words for these guys?
I did. So Buchanan's last words were, quote, whatever the result may be, I shall carry to my grave the consciousness that at least I meant well for my country. O Lord God Almighty, as thou wilt. Sounds really fancy for someone's last words. Who knows?
Yeah, that doesn't sound like someone breathing their last breaths. Yeah, somebody wrote that. His publicist wrote that.
So Pierce was asked about what he would do now that he's leaving the presidency. And he said, quote, there's nothing left. but to get drunk.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was like, you know what? That's the best quote out of all of them.
It really is.
Now, granted, he did turn into a bit of an alcoholic and had a drinking problem. But so we're making light of that, which we shouldn't. But it does give you a sense of the mood.
Yeah, it is not a coincidence that at the top of the show, I started it with a hold my beer joke because, yeah, both of these guys like to kick one back a little bit. No judgment, just a fact. I did have one thing that Buchanan once said or wrote. I can't remember where this was, but he said or wrote, "The wisest and most sagacious men become dunces when seized by a desire for the presidency." And it's a great quote, but that's exactly what happened to him. He was wise, but he became a dunce. He wanted to be president so badly, and he really, really underperformed. Well, the signature achievements for these guys, such as they are, for Pierce, I had the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Not a great achievement, but it, you know, that's what you got. Buchanan, I got just not intervening as the South is boiling over and seceding. What do you got for their signature?
Literally the same on both, yeah.
Not to mention the fact, honorable mention, but Pierce was our most handsome president. He was a very sharp-looking cat.
Where, who, according to who? Most handsome according to
I read it in like three different places. They're like, he was a gorgeous man. I don't know. He and our previous guy, Millard Fillmore, just beautiful men make bad presidents, unless they're Barack Obama, apparently, because, yeah, he's a good-looking cat, too.
JFK. Yeah. JFK.
JFK. Oh, JFK. There's another. Should we do handsomest presidents at some point? We should definitely do that for a Mount Rushmore. Yeah. Awesome. What is the lasting legacy of these guys, Ryan?
So for Pierce, I had that he was just completely unqualified for the role.
Oh,
he was
poor guy. I feel bad for this guy. I'm just gonna put that out there. Yeah.
Yeah. He got overpowered by, you know, men like Stephen Douglas, who were just more qualified and more aggressive Southern politicians. He got pressured into going along with the just completely disastrous Kansas-Nebraska Act. And for those reasons, he's kind of complicit in helping cause the Civil War. For Buchanan, it's simple. He's the president who helped cause the Civil War and then did nothing to try to stop it or prevent it. And that's it.
Before we die, Ryan, will he ever not be the worst president on that C-SPAN?
You know, I had a note about that. It would take Trump getting reelected. And then, because I don't think Trump did enough in his first term to surpass Buchanan. Yeah. It would take Trump getting reelected and then doing something so horrific, like trying to become a dictator. It would take something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, for patriotic saints, I'm really stretching on this one. I had for Pierce administrative integrity, because the only good compliment I found about him was that his cabinet was scandal free. They were just incompetent. They didn't have any problems. They were just, and it was the only cabinet that stayed together for all 4 years. So because I want to give each guy something nice. This is your little participation award. Cabinet integrity, administrative integrity. That's what I got for Pierce.
I'm just riffing off this. Pierce is the patriotic saint of the psychological stat that we trust handsome, beautiful people more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good
Even if
too.
They don't deserve it, we just trust them more.
That's why we're so trustworthy. Mm-hmm. Buchanan, absolutely. I'm sorry. The best I could do was just, he's the patriotic saint of what not to do. I'm not trying to be mean here. I'm not trying to troll this guy, but I'm like, I got nothing for you, Buchanan. So do the opposite of this guy and you'll be on the right path. Let's take a closer look at these guys. Ryan, good hang, bad hang. Who are you hanging out with?
So before they were presidents, I would have definitely said Pierce. It sounded like he was quite fun, especially in college.
Yeah.
Like, not just like, He drank a lot, but he was actually like apparently life of the party, really well-liked, sociable.
I'm going to be so bold as to say that from what I've heard about you, Ryan, I think you were Franklin Pierce when you were in college. I think you two would have got along gangbusters. Buchanan apparently had the greatest inaugural ball. Like, it was this huge party, the biggest party of the 19th century. And yet he was very formal. He was very boring. His nickname was Old Buck, but people didn't call it to his face because he didn't like it. And I loved this. They also called him Old Public Functionary. Like, that was like, that was like as friendly as they could be with him, you know? And so, So I'm going to go with Pierce, the young Pierce, not the brooding older, my heart has been ripped out of me, Pierce. Yeah, that's when you got to hang out with him when he's young. Let's chop down some cherry trees. What myths exist from this era, Ryan?
Mine's going to take a minute. Do you want me to go first? Or you want to get
I'll
yours
do,
out of the
I'll
way
do
first.
Three quick ones. John Brown was not a lone nut. He was neither alone, nor was he a nut. He proved himself to be just an ardent supporter, and I'm not going to tolerate slavery anymore. So that was something that was taught to me, that he was a crazy guy. Cherry tree, he was just willing to do a lot more than I'd be willing to do in the face of slavery. Second one, the Republican Party was not founded as anti-slavery. which is what I was always taught, and which is what the Republicans love to tell us, the Republican Party was founded to be anti-slaveholding Southerners obtaining more power. And I thought that that was a really important distinction, because there are a lot of Republicans who are like, I can take or leave slavery, but I don't like that they're getting power. Let's just back off ourselves there, Republican Party, a little bit, because I don't think you were as perfect as you thought.
Quick, and the last trivia question, do you know where the Republican Party was born?
Ripon, Wisconsin?
Ripon, Wisconsin, very good.
Yeah, I didn't know how to say the name, but yeah, Wisconsin. Thank you, Wisconsin. Every time I have an opportunity on this show, I should say thank you, Wisconsin. And the last one I have was that the conventional wisdom is that James Buchanan was indecisive about the South, and the author of his biography that I read said, no, it was not that he was indecisive about the South. It was that he was partial to the South. It was that he just chose not to intercede. And I thought that was, again, another important distinction. He wasn't tearing his hair out going, what do we do? Winfield Scott was like, send the freaking reinforcements down to Fort Sumter or whatever. Buchanan was like, I don't wanna, you know? So it's like, it's more insidious than indecision. We can forgive someone who is indecisive and freaks out in the moment. He just let this happen. So those are my three cherry trees for this one.
So I have a big one.
Yes.
This is the biggest cherry tree I think I'll chop down the entire year.
I love
the entire history of this podcast.
I'm
considering this like a public service message. My cherry tree is to chop down that the Lost Cause narrative that the Civil War was not primarily caused by slavery. It actually was. But it was not caused by states' rights, tariffs, and economic differences. So I have to call this a cherry tree. So I'm going to first prove to you it's a cherry tree, right?
Yes, please.
Over 40% of Americans still think that slavery was not the primary cause of the Civil War. They instead cite other arguments. Many state standards around the country still list states' rights, economic and cultural differences as primary causes. A 2020 analysis of state standards around the country showed that 16 states still had states' rights listed before slavery as a cause, right? Many U.S. history textbooks, and I did a survey of this, and so did James Lowen for his famous book, they still provide either false information or they provide an incredibly vague statement, which doesn't explicitly say slavery, right? Now, to be clear, this isn't me saying this. This is like modern historians have been banging this drum for decades now, right? That slavery is the primary cause of the Civil War. And it's not really a debate about that. It's what the debate is how exactly is slavery the cause, right? Is it about extension of slavery into territories? Is it about something else? So to help you with that, they'll prove to those that are dubiously, you know, questioning that, because this is probably what they were taught, I have some primary sources. I'm coming with the receipts, okay? This is the declaration of the immediate causes which induce and justify the secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. This is why this is the document, right? Why they seceded, right? But an increasing hostility on the part of the non-slaveholding states to the institution of slavery has led to a disregard of their obligations. The northern states have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. Thus, the constitutional compact has been deliberately broken. Those non-slaveholding states have assumed the right of deciding upon the propriety of our domestic institutions and have denied the rights of property established in 15 of the states and recognized by the Constitution. They have denounced as sinful the institution of slavery. They have permitted the open establishment among them of societies whose avowed object is to disturb the peace, property of the other citizens of states. I.e., their argument is that basically they're not following the Fugitive Slave Act. They are going against slavery actively. That's why we're seceding. I have another one. The Cornerstone Speech by Alexander Stevens, Vice Presidency of the Confederacy. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. Lincoln's first inaugural. One section of our country believes slavery is right and ought to be extended, while the other believes it is wrong and ought not to be extended. This is the only substantial dispute. The fugitive slave cause of the Constitution and the law for the suppression of the foreign slave trade are each as well enforced, perhaps, as any law can be in a community where the moral sense of the people imperfectly supports the law itself. And his second inaugural, in the middle of the Civil War, these slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen or perpetuate and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union, even by war, while the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it. So why then did Americans, generations of Americans, learn this false story of the Civil War, you may ask? Why do we still learn it in many states? It's called the Lost Cause narrative. right? Something I haven't really mentioned yet, which was developed by William Dunning and his disciples at Columbia University after the Civil War. And basically the whole purpose of the Lost Cause was to make the South look less bad, right? So here are the three main tenets, because I'll save some for Reconstruction later. Number one, secession was about anything other than slavery. It was about states' rights. It was about tariffs. It was about protecting the Southern way of life. Number two, African Americans were, quote, faithful slaves, loyal to their masters and Confederate cause, and unprepared for freedom. And number three, the Confederacy was defeated militarily only because of the Union's overwhelming military advantages and resources and men, and Confederate soldiers were heroic and saintly, especially Robert E. Lee. And so to me, this is the most important and damaging cherry tree we have to knock down this podcast. So to be clear, slavery was the cause of the Civil War. End point.
I'm just going to check my pulse here for a moment because my heart's pounding. That was lovely. I love it. You know what? Can I give you, I'm going to give the audience here a little secret about this show. When Ryan is ready to roll, Ryan says the word right a lot. And so when like eight sentences into that, Ryan was like, right. And I was like, oh, he's going, he's cooking. Okay. Here we go. I love it. You're absolutely right.
Do I say right a lot?
You do. Yeah. You should ask your student. No. I'm not trying to give you a complex here. No. I'm just saying that's what I knew. I'm sorry to have pulled back the curtain on that, but no, that's okay. When I knew you were rolling. But you're right. Ironically enough, I love that. I'm not going to say anything else about that because that was a beautiful cherry tree, but you're right. It was slavery, y'all.
It seems so obvious and just common sense. Well, of course it was about slavery. It was like they needed to come up with other reasons. Yeah. And Americans have just like believed those reasons. Maybe it's because it's like people want to believe it's something more complex than it really is. Oh, it wasn't, you know, it's like the conspiracy theorists, or it's like, it's just people who want to be contrarian. It's like, oh, it wasn't slavery. It was, no, you're too simple-minded. It was tariffs. That's the real, I think it's,
I do think that's part of it. Yeah. I think, look yourselves in the mirror, ladies and gentlemen, that was the cause. It was the cause. Oh, that was a little Shakespeare. It is the cause. It is the cause, my soul. Whew, I'm just warm and tingly right now. Weirdest facts about each president. I mentioned that Pierce was the most handsome president. We also mentioned he struggled with alcoholism. No judgment. Do you have anything weird about Pierce?
I don't know if it's weird, but notable. He was friends in college with Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote a biography about him.
Yep, there you go. Absolutely.
Arguably his closest friend and ally in Congress was Jefferson Davis. He managed to get appointed Brigadier General in the Mexican-American War, despite the fact that he had never served in the military once in his life, simply because he had run Polk's presidential campaign. And I mentioned before in his presidential campaign, he was running against his former commanding officer. And then when he told his wife he had been nominated for president, she fainted because she was so upset at the prospect of having to go back to live in D.C. because D.C. was such a swampy hellhole. One historian called her the most tragic and unhappy first lady in American history. That's really sad.
Yeah, it's hard to dispute that. Two things for Buchanan are that one, he had exodeviation, which meant that his eyes didn't work in unison. Kind of they kind of looked askew of one another, which led to him having to lean forward when he's talking to people or close one eye or tilt his head forward. He was mocked for it. So obviously people are cruel. And then the other thing that I was going to say about him was, well, I was just thinking of it. Maybe I'm only going to have one thing here. I don't remember. Oh, well.
He was the last president born in the 18th century. I mentioned before, you mentioned he was a Federalist, which like was wild to me. Only president who have never married.
Well, why they sucked. We've spent a lot of time talking about why these guys sucked. We've probably covered it all. Anything else about you want
to? Yeah, that Buchanan, in particular, he viewed abolitionists as troublemakers who are the bigger threat to the Union than the Southern slave owners. And that's despite the fact that he personally was against slavery, but he viewed it as his duty to protect property and the interests of slave owners so much that he took the stance that abolitionists were the worser evil than the slave owners themselves, which is just like a wild reasoning to me.
And Pierce was there as well. Shout out to my dad for this research in his 1855 message to Congress. Pierce blamed abolitionists for trying to, quote, overturn American traditions. He described America as a white man's republic and claimed that the founders had believed in the hierarchy of the races, quote, in which free white men ruled over their subject races, Indian and African. So both of these guys, Northern, doughface, Southern sympathizing, anti-slavery, but pro-slave holder, anti-abolitionist guys. Who sucked the most, Ryan? Buchanan or Pierce? You got to pick one.
Buchanan. To me, Pierce was just in over his head, and Buchanan actually made more mistakes.
Yeah. And like I said, I have more sympathy for Pierce. He just got railroaded. To go back to one of our themes. Just a quick addendum to last month's hot take. I mentioned last month that there were three great rough drafts in American history, the Whig Party and the League of Nations and the Articles of Confederation. And Ryan made fun of me for making such obvious choices. Ryan threw out Prohibition as another one of the great rough drafts. I'd like to submit maybe Ryan, the fourth one is Antebellum America, that is the last rough draft of our country, that America prior to the Civil War was a rough draft for America after the Civil War.
Oh, that is a really good take that I would need more time to think about.
All right, you think about that. Right. Give me a hot take.
All right, first off, I'm going to give you a list of qualities for a president. You tell me if you think those skills could be important to being a good president, okay?
I'm ready.
Was a talented and skillful politician? Honest? Had considerable legal ability? In fact, was even considered a constitutional scholar? And was considered good at balancing varying coalition agendas? Do you think that person sounds like a good, potentially good president?
I think so, yes.
Those all describe James Buchanan.
Yeah, I knew it.
So my hot take is that Buchanan is another really good example that if how historical context and moment matters so much for presidential success, that you have to be the right man in the right moment. And I think my hot take is that if he had been president in another era, he might have been an average president. He could have even been in the right era, a very good president. He was just a really, really bad fit for the crises of his time. That's my hot take.
Yeah. I think
so. The
right guy,
he could have gone from worst president to middle of the pack to even upper third potentially.
I think you're absolutely right. He had all the raw material. The last take that I have, we should have let the South go. That's my take. We should have let the South go. And here's why. Now, I've had people say this to me in the past, America would have been better off if we let the South go. My answer to that was always no, because we needed to get rid of slavery. If we let the South go, we have the slaveocracy down there, and that's an immorality that we cannot let stand. However, if we had let the South go and the North had said, hey, you know what, South Carolina? You go right ahead, buddy. You go try it out on your own. We could have let the South go and ended slavery non-militarily. Couple of reasons. The rest of the Western world was already moving away from slavery. Lincoln could have sent Secretary of State Seward across to Europe and to say, hey, embargo, boycott, let's not do business with this slaveocracy. Let's just choke them off economically. Let's not do business with them until they give up their slaves. We could have had a Western world boycott of the South, and they would have been cut off from the rest of the world. Seceding would have nullified the power of the Fugitive Slave Act because all those slave states are gone. And the slaves would have found it a lot easier to get out of the country in which they are existing because they all only need to cross over the Ohio River now to get into a completely new country. So slaves escaping would be a lot easier. The constitutional protections of slavery would be nullified because there's no more slave states. And the northern legislatures could just be like, hey, anybody got a problem with us abolishing slavery right now? Should we just take care of that? Okay, sounds good. Let's go ahead and do that. And then the South would just wither, economically cut off, slaves going away left and right, and they could either be their own country and crumble under the weight of this dying slaveocracy, or they could come crawling back like the prodigal son and say, may we please come back into the United States? At which point the North could say, yes, you can, and welcome back, my son. But here are the new conditions of the new way we do things around here, right? And since the South would be coming back into the nation, having been sort of chastened amongst themselves, and they have worked through their process of letting go of slavery, it would no longer feel like the North forcing it upon them, and perhaps they would have been able to move on from this addiction to slavery maybe more gracefully and maybe a little bit more quickly. So had we just let them go and be like the prodigal son and go off and waste their fortune and come on back hat in hand, maybe we could have avoided 600 deaths and brutal civil war, and maybe we would have had better race relations because they would have realized through their own volition that slavery was wrong and it needed to end. That's my hot take.
That was really, really good. I think that might be my favorite hot take you've done all year.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, all last 2 years.
Boom! Today's terms. We got some entrance music. We got some fan base. We got modern politicians, athletes, actors, TV shows. Ryan, what is the entrance music for these guys?
So for Franklin Pierce, I have Over My Head by The Prey.
That's so good.
for Franklin Pierce, which was like a big hit. It was on Grey's Anatomy, I think. It had like a famous moment on Grey's.
Over my head.
Yeah. So I have that. Yeah.
That was really strong. I have an entrance song for both of them. I'm going to go with Pompeii by Bastille. The whole song is about the destruction of this beautiful civilization by the volcano. And the song is, you know, where do we begin, the rubble or our sins? You know, like there's all these things in that song about how these two guys together just let this society just bust apart. And it all exploded when Mount Vesuvius of slavery, Pompeii, Bastille. That's my song.
I like it.
For fan bases, did you have a Buchanan fan base?
Yes. I'm stealing it, though, from the era.
Okay, good. Go.
Cheating. The Buchananeers.
Yes, that's what I thought too. The fact that this guy had a fan base just tells you all we need to know about this era.
Yeah, it was an actual group. Yeah. It was like the guys that did his dirty fighting for him in the campaign.
Yeah.
But it's just it was too good. I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna Buchananeers. Yeah.
I'm with you. Yeah, the Buchananeers. Really, yeah. Well done. For Pierce, I just want to do a quick shout out in honor of Benjamin Franklin Hawkeye Pierce from MASH, played by Alan Alda. And MASH was my favorite show as a kid. I think the Hawkeyes are going to be Pierce's nickname, only because shout out to Alan Alda and MASH and the show that formulated a lot of my sense of humor. What modern politician is their equivalent? This was a tough one, Ryan. What you got?
I thought it was actually somewhat easy-ish.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I have one for both. I have Neville Chamberlain for Buchanan.
Yep.
Appeasement. And then I have for Pierce, George W. Bush.
Tell me more about George.
Just like a good-looking, affable guy, but in over his head and not a good president.
For Pierce, I'm going to rip one from current events, and I'm going to say that the modern politician who is the equivalent of Pierce is Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. Because Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, like Pierce, was a relative unknown before he was thrust into the spotlight. He was a compromise candidate because we couldn't figure out who the heck was going to be Speaker of the House. We had a whole bunch of votes. The Republicans were voting and voting and voting and voting. Finally, they settle on this guy where everybody's like, how about him? Okay, sounds good. I'm not exactly sure what his credentials are, no offense, and I'm not exactly sure what his contributions are to anything. And much like Pierce did not get renominated by his party for the presidency, our guy, Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is facing some conflict from within his own ranks. The Republicans seem to be not very happy with him. And so I got Mike Johnson as my Franklin Pierce. What athlete are these presidents, Ryan? You go first.
So I was pretty proud of this one. For me, like I talked about before, Buchanan, if the conditions had been better, he'd have been really good, right? But under difficult conditions, he just wilted. So I wanted an athlete where, like, when the conditions are right, everything's right around him, looks really good, puts up great numbers. But then when things get tough or when things get, you know, scrambled around him, not so great. So I went with Kirk Cousins.
Yeah. You
know? He's gone now. Sorry, he's not a Viking.
Sorry, Mom. No, I know. No. That's good. That's okay. Okay.
Because to me, Kirk Cousins is like the college quarterback that like puts up huge numbers against like these cupcake teams, and then as soon as they play Alabama, they just can't do anything. You know, that was him.
Yeah. Well done. Well played. We always do this, Ryan. We always have the same, like, we're in the same phylum. I did one for each. For Pierce, I had Johnny Manziel because kind of like huge rise and then huge fall. And kind of a partier, wild child. I understand he liked having a good time. So Johnny Football was who I had for Franklin Pierce. And for Buchanan, I went with Ryan Leaf because not only was Ryan Leaf one of the great busts of all time, the quarterback in the NFL, not only bad on the field, but also off the field. But the other thing about Ryan Leaf is that when you say Ryan Leaf's name, the next name you need to say is Peyton Manning, one of the greats, one of the NFL greats. And when you say Buchanan's name, the next name you need to say is Abraham Lincoln, because they're right next to each other. So that just kind of reminded me of that his the ignominy of his career is only heightened by the fact that he was in such close proximity with one of the all-time greats. What actor should play these people? So for Pierce, I have Hugh Jackman, because he's very dashing, he's very charismatic, and as you said, as a young man, Pierce was very charismatic. But he also can play very dark and brooding, and he can get, you know, just creepy and gloomy. So after the death of his child, Hugh Jackman was my Franklin Pierce actor. I'd love to see it.
I like that. And it's good.
Thank you. And because we've had a theme on this show of doppelgangers, I need everybody to go online and Google a picture of James Buchanan, and then Google a picture of Tracy Letts. And I'm going to tweet this out as well, because I have a picture of the actor and playwright Tracy Letts, who was in movies like Ford versus Ferrari. Uh-huh. And I have a picture of him, I think, in Ford versus Ferrari, and he's standing in the exact same posture as James Buchanan. And I'll tweet this out again, but they are absolute doppelgangers of one another. No. Tracy Letts, also a very accomplished playwright. He wrote August Osage County. Great play. No. But these two look exactly the same.
I'm looking it up, and it does look a lot like him.
There you go. Awesome.
For Buchanan, I'm reusing an actor. Okay. I'm reusing Anthony Hopkins, because
nice.
I think it kind of looks like him a little bit, maybe.
Yeah.
For Pierce, I have Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he can pull off the looks and the broodingness, but also he could pull off the social stuff. I think obviously he's a really good actor. So I want Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah.
Big fan of those. What TV show should be made about them?
My first idea was a 6-episode miniseries biopic on John Brown. I found out they made it.
Yes. Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, and I didn't know that.
I had the exact same idea. That was literally the first thing So I haven't seen it. It's called The Good Lord Bird. Yeah. And it sounds like it's really good. But yes, I haven't seen this thing. I want to see this thing, but I'm so glad we landed on the right place.
I didn't have a backup, because like, to me, that was the most interesting story. I mean, the other one would have been like a legal drama about the Dred Scott case, but like, you know how it's going to end.
I do have another story, but I'm going to save it for the next part of this show. So we've arrived at the part of the show where Ryan and I are now going to take a look at the walls of America's history classrooms, and we are going to decide what one face from American history ought to represent the years 1853 to 1861. Already we have James Buchanan and Franklin Pierce on our list. Ryan and I are now going to add three more names: personal pick, a dark horse candidate, and a contender. After that, we will vote to see which person or people are meant to go on that wall. Now, because we've talked about a whole bunch of really bad people, I just want to remind everybody that the rule is not who is the best person, like who is the most morally upright person. The category here is who is the person whose story or presence symbolizes America during these times. So my personal pick is the aforementioned John Brown. If we go back through his story, he was agitating in Kansas. He was agitating at Harper's Ferry. He was actually kind of the founder of slacktivism. You know, we have this phrase now, slacktivism, where people sit on their computers and they, you know, they type messages onto social media, like, you know, with their social statements. And after John Brown actually went to Harper's Ferry and was like killing people, people were writing letters to one another being like, yeah, I totally would have done that. And so I think he's a really important guy for this era. And plus, like, he was, you know, misconstrued as a wild man, a madman, or whatever. But he's just the unrelenting voice in the wilderness saying we got to get rid of slavery. So I got John Brown as my personal pick.
He's my contender.
Boom. So that's my personal pick. Who's your personal pick, Ryan?
I have Stephen Douglas.
That's my contender. This is going to be very interesting. Okay. Talk about it.
It might be a split vote. Architect of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, as we talked about, and the debates with Lincoln, and then ultimately you ran as a Democrat in 1860 for president. So politically, I mean, obviously his decision to do the Kansas-Nebraska Act is arguably, in this 8 years, the most important part of causing the Civil War. So I have him.
You know? I had only known him from the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I had no idea his fingerprints were all over this 8-year span. And like you said, lost the presidency to Lincoln, stood by the Union, and he, that's to his credit, even though, like I said earlier, he had some pretty racist things to say. But yeah, Stephen Douglas absolutely belongs on this list. Let's talk about some dark horses. My dark horse is the aforementioned William Still. And the reason I liked William Still, this is the gentleman who was born into a family of former enslaved people. He became part of the Vigilance Society in Pennsylvania. He met his brother, again, just randomly after 40 years. But the reason I think he's a great story is not just him, but because really his family shows sort of all the various roads that slavery took. His father bought his freedom. His mother escaped as a slave. She had to leave behind several children in order to escape. She was recaptured and brought back to the South. The son who came into his office was born outside of slavery and then brought into slavery when his mother was recaptured. The brother who got out of slavery, he wanted to go back in and get his wife out. And there's this incredible book called The Underground Railroad Records, written by William Still. And it's the stories of all the enslaved people who came through his office and went through the Underground Railroad. And it's their true stories of how they survived or how they succeeded or how they failed. But going back to our previous topic, Ryan, this is the show we should have. The Underground Railroad Records, true life stories of the slaves who tried to escape from the South. I read just a couple of these, and these are incredible, incredible tales. So that's, I think, the story we need to make. That would be just, I think, incredible show. That's my dark horse.
My dark horse contender is Dred Scott himself.
Yes.
Rather than do Roger Taney, did the guy, the plaintiff, yeah, the guy that was, you know, enslaved and had the audacity and courage to bring forward a suit and lends his name to this infamous case and kind of a symbol, one human symbol of what really was at the heart of this conflict, which was slavery.
Okay. So here's what we have, ladies and gentlemen. James Buchanan is on the list. Franklin Pierce is on the list. John Brown, Dred Scott, William Still, and Stephen Douglas. Those are the six people that Ryan and I are about to rank and vote for. When we come back, we will have the winners of the years 1853 to 1861. We'll be right back. We are back, ladies and gentlemen, and we are ready to go. So here are the results. In sixth place, sorry, Franklin Pierce, thank you for your service. You were just in over your head, as Ryan pointed out with the song. In fifth place, we had William Still. I really hope we can get that show made, but he's not going up on the American history classrooms. In fourth place, we have James Buchanan. For all of his faults, he was a very important figure in terms of letting the whole place burn down. In third place, we have Dred Scott. As a first in reframing America history, ladies and gentlemen, we have a tie. We have Stephen Douglas and John Brown both going up on the wall, replacing Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan. Two pictures going up on the wall because they tied for first place. Ryan, we're taking down Pierce and Buchanan. We are putting up John Brown and Stephen Douglas. How does this reshape or reframe our understanding of American history?
Well, it includes the politician that's probably more important in terms of orchestrating it, and includes a human symbol of the abolitionist movement, even in its most extreme and violent form, and a guy who helped cause an event that was a key cause of the Civil War. So it's all about the, you know, the behind the scenes guys that, you know, helped cause the Civil War, yeah, as opposed to the presidents who failed to prevent it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I want to make sure to give an extra special thank you to all of you for slogging through this series of presidents we've had the last couple of months. But we have a really nice treat for you next month, because next month, Ryan and I are just licking our chops. We are going to talk about Abraham Lincoln. We're going to talk about the Civil War. Come on back for our season two finale next month. In the meantime, please continue to tell your friends, your family about this show. Please find us on Twitter at Painted Sky Pods. Please email us with questions or yell at us for our misogyny by emailing us at PaintedSkyPodcasts@gmail.com, or call me. Most of you have my number probably. Please make sure to go online. If you like this show well enough to listen to it for an hour and a half, you like this show well enough to go on and review it. So please help us out at Spotify, at Apple Podcasts. The more ratings we get, the more we get this show out to other people. I want to give a shout out to my brother Pete, one of our most faithful listeners. He even listens to this podcast before he listens to his other podcasts. This one's always at the top of his list. And sorry, Pete, for ruining your birthday by not having this podcast out in time for it. We were going to have this podcast out about a week ago, and I got a text from him. He was not happy with me that I didn't have his birthday podcast for
Pete,
him.
You said Pete?
Yeah, Pete.
Pete, you can blame me. It wasn't a good week for me with all my grading. I needed a week where I had more time.
Ryan, he's an older brother. He's absolutely going to blame me. Don't worry about it. Yeah, this has nothing to do with you. This is 40 years of history right here. Yeah, Pete, it's all on me, buddy. Thank you, Ryan, as ever, for being here.
Thank you, Tony.
And thank you all for listening to Reframing America.
Boom!